So first of all, about this talk, we are going to review our work that we've done over about the past 8-9 months to look into using Postgres as a database, R as an analytical engine, and a piece of code called PLR as sort of glue between them, and apply it to server monitoring to see if we can do some more kind of sophisticated a more sophisticated approach to predicting the fact that that there's a problem going on with the server and that we want to maybe take some action. At this point in the work we've done, this is not a turnkey solution. We're not going to provide you with, you know, here, just install this package and it's going to solve all your problems. But I think what you will get out of this is, number one, if you're familiar with Postgres, hopefully you'll learn some interesting techniques just in use of Postgres. And number two, you'll learn some interesting techniques in using R with Postgres to do data analysis. So in a way, this presentation is sort of a wrapper around an underlying topic, which is an interesting way to use Postgres to do data analysis on big data, potentially. The idea is, again, typical server monitoring, you're looking at trends, you look at a graph that shows you something is going awry, but our goal here is to be able to collect the data and analyze it analytically with statistics and see if we can predict the fact that something is either just starting to happen or about to happen bad to us. Just as a slight digression, how many people in here, first of all, are familiar with Postgres? That's great. Large number of people. That's good. How many people here are familiar with R? Not too bad. So R is a very popular analytics engine these days. It's being used in a lot of different industries and a lot of different types of use cases. PLR, if you're familiar with Postgres, you probably know the fact that Postgres is very extensible, kind of at its core. It was designed that way in the beginning. There's a number of procedural languages that are available that ship with Postgres. You can write functions for Postgres in Python, in Perl, in a native language called PLPGSQL, which is sort of like Oracle's PLSQL. And then there's an API that allows you to write a handler and plug in any arbitrary language. And so PLR is that wrapper around R. It allows you to write functions in the R language and execute them from within the Postgres process. So you're doing your analytics close to your data. And I'm going to definitely be showing you that's another aspect of this talk is we're going to be going through a lot of code. So I'll take my time and feel free to ask questions if something's not clear as I go. In terms of why you might want to use something like PLR, this is just kind of a laundry list of reasons why you might want to use something like that. If you're doing analytics, you often have a group of people that understand the analytics. You have a separate group of people who understand database stuff. With a plugin like PLR, you can have your statisticians sort of bottle up the analysis that they want to do. You cut and paste that into a function, and now anyone who runs a query on your database can run that set of analytics. You leverage the hardware better than, say, having a guy with a laptop who's pulling a gigabyte of data down to his laptop in order to perform the analysis. You might as well do that on your 24-core or 64-gigabyte server. Also, why transfer gigabytes of data across your LAN when you can just do all that in process and spit out the result 42? And you get consistency. Once you've packaged some kind of analysis that you're doing into a PLR function, now it's just being called in a parameterized way, and so you know that when, developer A versus developer B, as long as they're using the same function, you're getting the same analysis. You're not getting something that's done slightly differently. And it keeps the whole system understandable and maintainable. And, as I said, R has a huge ecosystem around it, and you're going to leverage that by using PLR. So now to talk a little bit more about, this talk is kind of split into two halves. I'm going to talk for the first half about our methodology, how we set out to collect the data and how we simulated load on our server as we were collecting the data. And then in the second half of the talk, Jeff is going to go into some of the more deep analytics that we're applying, or at least trying to apply to this problem, to see if we can eke out some insights into what's going on. So in order to keep this simple, we're using database function, and we're using cron to do the data collection. We're also using cron to do the simulated data loads. We did this in a couple of different phases. We did a first set of tests where we use PLPG SQL to do the data collection, and we use native Postgres arrays to store the data. And then we did a second iteration where we use PLR and R objects to store the data. So in that second case, we're actually storing the data in a table, which is an R object. So we're taking an R object that's been prepared in the R language and returning it as binary to Postgres and then storing it in a table and then doing post-processing on that. And I've got an example of how that works, which has got interesting other use cases as well. So the first step is to decide what are we going to collect. We're trying to monitor our servers. What kind of data do we want to collect? As you can well imagine, there's probably thousands of different variables you could collect. In order to do our experiment, we just wanted to pick a reasonable number of them that we thought might prove interesting. So this is the list that we decided to collect. Active and total sessions. And when I talk about sessions, those are Postgres sessions. So if you're familiar with Postgres, Postgres is a process model. Every connection to the Postgres database spawns its own process. It's a back-end process. That process can either be connected to something that's active, in other words, it's a query that's actually running and doing work, or it can be inactive. If you just connect to Postgres and then sit there at the PSQL prompt and do nothing, you've got an idle connection, but it's still a connection. We looked at blocks fetched and blocks hit. So the difference there being the blocks hit are things that are being pulled right out of Postgres in-memory cache versus blocks fetched, which are blocks that are of data that are being pulled by Postgres from the operating system. Now, we can't tell whether those are coming from the operating system's cache, at least not at this particular level. There are other ways we could go get that data as well, and we do some of that with some of the things down below here. But as far as Postgres is concerned, the difference there is whether or not Postgres thinks we're going to disk to get the data or we're pulling it out of Postgres cache. The cache hit fraction, which is basically how much of the stuff that we're querying is coming out of cache. It's an important metric for a database. How many lock weights we're seeing. Now we're down to things that are coming from the operating system, memory free and memory cached, swap free, I/O wait and CPU idle time, and then blocks read and written per second and blocks read and written. This is OS level type stuff. And then finally, we decided that the amount of time that it took to capture all this metrics that we're capturing once a minute or once every 2 or 3 minutes in and of itself is sort of an indicator of how much load is on the server. So the amount of time it takes to run the queries in order to get this data or capture time ends up being one of the more interesting metrics that we had. So now I'm going to show you some of the SQL behind how we capture these metrics. Again, there's a fair number of people here who are familiar with Postgres. How many of you are familiar with Postgres functions? Creating not quite as many. So this is a typical method for creating a function in Postgres. Create a replace function is the syntax, the name of the function. Any arguments that you need to pass would go in here. and then what it's returning. One of the things that was added a few releases ago to Postgres is the ability to use this double dollar sign quoting, which allows us to replace the single tick mark quoting so that when you have single tick marks in the body of your function, you can leave them as single tick marks instead of having to double them and then redouble them and then redouble them. In the old days, it used to be that sometimes when you're writing a function like this, you could wind up with, you know, 8 single tick marks around something because you had a string inside of a string inside of a string kind of thing. So by using these double dollar signs, we can avoid that. Basically, if you have a dollar sign with anything in between it and another dollar sign, as long as it matches the beginning and the end, kind of like a here doc, everything in between is viewed as a string. And in Postgres, when you define a function, this is a string. This string will then get passed down to whatever the interpreter that's going to be operating on it. This particular function is a SQL function, so this is just native SQL. This is also showing another feature of SQL, which is part of the SQL standard. It's not specific to Postgres, but it's the notion of something called a common table expression, which is that this with clause is defining these three pseudo tables or virtual tables that are themselves subselects. And then in the main body of the select, I'm just referring to those as if they were tables. Do you see this in the back reasonably well? Yeah? So in this case, what we're doing is we're using some functions that are available built into Postgres. This pgstat getDBBlocksHit is giving us the blocks hit out of the cache, whereas this DBBlocksFetched is giving me the blocks that are Postgres Thinker are getting, at least getting pulled from the OS. Again, an interesting sidebar to this. In Postgres, in the documentation online, by the way, is excellent. There's a bunch of views that are defined for the statistics data. And in case you weren't familiar with it, one of the things you can do in PSQL is this. If you use this syntax, this slash D is basically a describe in Postgres, and a plus means give me extra information. So if I do slash D plus and then the name of the view, it not only has given me all of the fields and their data types from the view, it's also given me the definition of the view itself. And if you look into the definition of the view, you see all of these function calls that are passing it. In this case, it's getting it for a database, all this data for a database. All of this data is available inside of Postgres for you to query. And these functions themselves that are behind this view are actually not really very well documented. So this is sort of an insider's look at how you could pull individually get these data points out of Postgres. So in this case, I didn't want to use the view because the view is pulling a bunch of stuff that I don't need and just adds extra overhead that I didn't want. So I call those two functions directly, divide them, wrap them in a case statement, and just in case the blocks fetched is zero, I don't want to have an error for dividing by zero. So that's how I'm going to get my cache hit fraction. Now I'm going to show you the first instance of a PLR function. As of Postgres 9.1, I think it was, there was a new feature called extensions. Postgres is always extensible. You could always sort of add stuff by creating the individual functions that supported it. But in 9.1, this feature was added, this notion of an extension, which allows you to sort of install a bunch of stuff as a package, which also lets you uninstall it as a package, and it makes it easier when you're doing Postgres upgrades to have the stuff carry forward. So at this point, as long as you've got PLR installed at the OS level, either through an RPM or a Debian package or if you've installed it through source code, whatever, then all you have to do is type create extension PLR, and now you've got PLR in this database. And that's true for any other extension that's available for Postgres. So I'm going to define this function rmeminfo. And again, now I'm showing you an example of one that's returning multiple rows. So this is a function that's going to return multiple rows using this keyword set of text. And in R, I've got a system command available. So all I'm going to do is say cat proc meminfo. So this is going to take this system command, bring it into the R interpreter as text, and basically just return it to Postgres. So if I do that, you can see that I've got some interesting looking data here. But all of these things are strings. So I've got a bunch of rows of data, but these are all strings, so it'd be hard to do any kind of analytics on this. So the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to create another function, meminfo. I'm defining these parameters as out parameters, which basically means they're not things I'm feeding to the function, it's things that the function's passing back. So it defines a return tuple for this function. I'm going to again say it returns a set of, and now I'm going to say record, because a record is an amorphous thing. And I've defined my record here. It's basically it's a text and an int, a big int. And I'm going to use some functionality in just built into Postgres, split part, which says split apart my string on certain characters and into individual values and then return it. So now when I run this function, just select meminfo, now I get all that data back as two columns, a metric and a value. Now that's something I can actually do something with. And you can see there's a ton of data that comes out of that command. I'm only using a small fraction of it, at least in this presentation. So now here's another example. I'm going to use iostat. This particular function is going to just take the output of iostat, and it's going to replace multiple spaces with single spaces. And then it makes it easier for me to parse that out so I can pull out specifically IO wait and CPU idle. So the iostat function is just going to give me back, if you're familiar with iostat, it just gives me stuff like this system time, IO wait, idle time. And all this first function just returns it as a string that's space delimited, and then these other two functions just split it out so I can get the piece of data that I want off them. So now if I do So you can see again, this is a string. It would be hard to do anything with it. But once I've reformatted the data, now I get data points that I can make use of. And again, in this case, I'm just using just simple SQL functions to do the parsing. This one's a bit bigger, just because the parsing challenge was more. But it's the same basic idea. It's iostat D is going to return a number of rows depending on how many devices you have. In this case, there are actually six output fields, the device itself, blocks read, blocks written per second, blocks read, blocks written, all of which, those last four are the ones I was interested in. And these are these two functions are taking blocks read per second, blocks written per second, and just selecting them from that other function. And then the same thing for blocks read and blocks written. So you see, if I call select star from, and this, I didn't really mention this before, but if you've got a function that returns rows and columns in Postgres, and again, this is not specific to PLR, this is just generic to Postgres, you can put that in the from clause as if it were a table. It's essentially a virtual table. And then you just select from it. So if I just select star from that function, I'm going to get all these fields, and those wrapper functions I created just allow me to pull specific fields out of it as individual data values. In a few minutes, you'll see why I did that. It just facilitated the data collection I was doing. Okay, so actually now's the time I'm going to show you how we're collecting the data. So all of those functions are being used to collect data. In order to automate the collection of the data, the first thing we did was we created a table called metrics. We've got a name for the metric. The important fields here are the name for the metric and then the actual SQL that's going to be executed to collect that metric. So some of these things I didn't even need to create functions for. If I do, I talked earlier about active sessions. In Postgres, there's this, again, it's a view. It's a virtual view called pgstatActivity that tells you who's connected to the database and what are they doing, essentially, including the SQL statements they're running and how much I/O they're taking and a bunch of other kind of interesting things that come from some of those other functions that I showed you. But I can do a simple query. I can do a count from pgstatActivity where my state is not equal to idle and the process ID is not equal to my process ID. And what that does is it gives me a count of how many active connections there are at this instant in time to my database. And if I do just a simple count from that view, I'm going to get all connections to the database, so the ones that are idle as well as the ones that are active. For blocks fetched, I'm just going to use that built-in function that I showed you how to find earlier, pgstat_get_db_blocks_fetched. In this case, I've got a subquery inside the argument for that function, which is just giving me my database object ID for my current database. So that's going to give me the blocks fetched for my current database that I'm in, and blocks hit similarly. The cache hit fraction was the function I defined earlier and showed it to you. Lock weights, again, there's a virtual view in Postgres called pglocks. And you basically do a select count from pglocks where not granted. So if a lock is not granted, basically that means there's a session that's waiting on the ability to acquire the lock. So that's a lock wait by definition. Select the value from meminfo where the metric is equal to memfree, and the same thing where it's equal to cache. So this is giving me my free memory from the operating system level and my cached, my swap free, my I/O wait, and my CPU idle. So again, each of these you can see is just a SQL statement that's getting stored in a table. And these are all using the functions that I showed you earlier. Now, I defined these things up through 15, and then I skipped to 32. And the reason I did that is I decided up front that from an efficiency standpoint, I just wanted to define an array that I was going to collect my data into, and I needed to figure out ahead of time how many slots I wanted to be in that array. So I decided there'd be 32 slots in the array for data, and as I was going through setting this all up, I decided, you know, 15 pieces or 16 pieces of data was enough to do what we wanted to do. So basically slots 16 through 31 are reserved for future use, if you will. And then 32 is this capture time. This is the amount of time it takes to run all 15 of those prior queries. So the data that gets collected by this is all going to be stored in a table called measurement. It's a pretty simple table. It just has a field for the timestamp, the time when this data was captured, and a float array. This is the notation that you use in Postgres for defining an array. So this is a float. This is an array of float values. So all my metrics data is going to go into this vals field, and the timestamp for when the data got collected is going to go into that TS field. And then I'm going to define a PLPG SQL function, which I'm going to utilize to actually collect the data for me. So in PLPG SQL, if you're familiar with Oracle's PLSQL, it's very similar. It's not 100% identical, but it should look very familiar to you if you're familiar with Oracle. You have this declare section where you're declaring your variables. You define, in this case, I'm saying that ST variable is defined as the current clock timestamp. There are a number of different ways to get time in Postgres that are built in. One thing just to note is that several of them will give you the time at the beginning of the transaction that you're currently in, which means if you call them several times within the same transaction, you'll get the same result. Clock timestamp actually gives you the instant in time at which it's been called. So if it was called even multiple times within the same SQL statement, you know, in different target list variables, you would get different times. At least if things were slow enough where it could differentiate down at the microsecond level, you'd get a different time. This is the way you define a loop in PLPG SQL. So I'm saying I've got an amorphous record type in this select statement, and my select is basically going to grab the name of the metric, the ID number, which I'm going to use for my index into the array where I'm storing the data, and the SQL itself, which is going to get executed from my metrics table. I'm doing that for all the metrics less than 32, because 32 I've kind of said is my special metric of the amount of time it took to collect all the data. And then inside that loop, I'm just going to execute the SQL that was stored in that table. So this is dynamic execution of SQL. And I'm going to execute that into a variable called res, which is just a float 8 variable. These things were all defined to return a float 8. And then I'm going to stuff that value in the array at the array index defined by the ID. So I'm going to run those 15 SQL statements that were stored in that metrics table. I'm going to store all the results in this vals array, which is just an array of floats. I'm taking a timestamp at the beginning and at the end. I stuff the difference between those into index 32. And then I'm going to insert into my measurement table the time at the beginning and the array of values that I collected. And then at the very end here, I'm doing something called pgstat reset. One of the things about the statistics collector for Postgres is it sort of runs on forever, and so any statistics are cumulative. Depending on what you're trying to get out of your data collection, you might not want that. And you can always do the cumulative aspect of that yourself if you want. So if you run this pgstat reset, it basically just zeroes out all the counters that are collected by Postgres so that the next time this runs, it'll get just the incremental stuff since the last time it ran. And then finally, it's just going to return. So when I executed, I just wanted to be able to debug and see that it was returning what I expected. So it returns to the caller the array that it collected. But the important part here is that that data got inserted into this table. So then I'm just going to create a cron job, which runs PSQL on my database. Dash C means just execute this command. And then all I have to do to execute the command is just say select that function I just showed you. And it goes and pulls out all that SQL, executes it all, builds my array, inserts it in my measurements table, and I'm done. And I can just pipe the output to dev null. So this is now going to collect all that data once a minute from my server. So I told you in the second phase of this investigation, and we said, well, let's see what it would look like if we did this with R objects instead of native Postgres arrays. And you know, there's several reasons you might want to do that. If you want to do anything fancy with the statistics, you can do pre-processing to build up an R object that's almost arbitrary in nature in terms of its nesting and what things are attached to it, and then store it in a table as a binary object, and later on reconstitute it and do your statistics on it. And one of the early things we decided we were going to try was to see if we could apply statistical process control or traditional SPC to this process. And in SPC, you typically collect multiple data points and then look at the statistics of the group and kind of manipulate the group statistics. And so in the second iteration of this thing, we created a separate table. Still got a timestamp, but in this case, the sample group is defined as byte A, which in Postgres is the binary data type. And I'm going to shove R objects in there that have not just one data collection, but actually three data collections. Or I've actually defined it in a way that it's flexible. You could do more than three, but that's the way we did it. So each of the objects that gets inserted into this table is going to have three sets of data that's been collected and some summary statistics over that set. This capture function is a fair bit longer and more complicated. It's done in PLR itself. Some of the interesting things to note here, again, not necessarily completely relevant to this particular talk, but one of the aspects of PLR is that there's also in R, just like a lot of other languages, there are extensions to allow that language to reach into a Postgres database. In R, there's something called R Postgres SQL, which allows you from an R command line to query your database. Well, a few releases ago for PLR, I decided, you know, it'd be pretty cool if you could just have a statistician who doesn't know anything about database stuff develop their analysis just using the R command line, and they want to query the database to get the data to develop their analysis. But then you ought to be able to just cut and paste that into a PLR function, and it ought to just work. So there's basically compatibility functions in PLR, some of which are no ops, like this require R Postgres SQL. In PLR, that wouldn't actually be useful, but if you were doing this from an R console in order to develop the statistics that you're running in the first place, that's necessary. So that's why this is commented out here. I'm going to initialize some variables, basically vals, into a matrix, which is going to be equal to my group size by my number of columns, and times, which is going to be the size of my group size. Again, these two statements are no ops in PLR, but if you were doing this from an R console, you would need to say you're using the Postgres driver for your database and create a connection to it. The SQL string is just really the same query that you saw in that PLPG SQL function that I showed you before. It's just selecting the SQL and the metric and the ID from the metrics table and stuffing it in a string, and then this is how you execute that string in R. And once you get that string, you're going to, again, there's an outer loop in this case because we're going to loop three times to collect the data three times. we're going to, because we're collecting the data three times, we're going to reset this PGStat each time we collect the data. And we're also going to sleep for a delta second. So this function is defined so that if you're going to collect three samples, you can sleep for 30 seconds, for instance, in between the samples. So once we've done the reset and the sleep, again, it looks pretty similar to what you saw in the PLPG SQL. We're going to collect what's the current time of the system. We're going to iterate through all of those SQL statements that we pulled out of the metrics table, collect the data, stuff it into a variable, get the final time. Now, in this case, because I'm working with an R object, there's some additional stuff. The differential time is the that final index 32. I stuff the time at the start of the collection into this TMS variable. And then I'm going to do some additional work down here. I'm going to keep track of what was the group size that I used for this particular data set of data collection. I'm going to attach my array of the timestamps for each of the data collections. I'm going to attach my matrix of values that were collected. And I'm going to do some averaging over my group, and I'm going to calculate the range of my group, because that's what you use in statistical process control. Then, again, this is not needed in PLR, but if you were in an R console, you would disconnect, and then finally that gets returned. And so if we were running this from cron, I ran it every 3 minutes instead of every 1 minute, and I actually do an insert into this measurement R object table, the current timestamp, and then this function capture all metrics that I just showed you using a group size of 3 and a sleep time of 30 seconds.
Assuming, I don't know that you could actually do this, but if you took the first approach and then this R object approach and you were using the PGStat reset inside of all these functions, are those global operations you have to worry about resetting stats on something that's expected not to reset between the intervals?
It's only if you are doing something else. I mean, Postgres itself doesn't use those. Those statistics are for monitoring purposes, so you can kind of define for yourself how you want to use them. So if you had another reason for looking at those statistics, then, yeah, you might care about that. You could always define your function so it did the delta calculation for you. That would require a little more work. I didn't do it. I took the lazy way. But either approach would work. Depending on your needs. So then, this is actually not really necessary for what we were doing, but I wanted to show you an example of how you might extract data out of that R object once it's stored in the table. So if you create this function, sample group delta TS, you're passing it a binary data type, which is that sample group that I stored in the table. And once you're in the PLR function, you're basically just extracting a piece of an R object. When you pass that binary object back into PLR, PLR just reconstitutes the R object the way it was when we passed it back to Postgres in the first place. So now all this thing does is it just peels off the piece that I wanted it and returns it back to Postgres. So let's talk for a minute about how we created load on the system for doing our testing. People here familiar with PGBench? No. Wow. So PGBench is distributed with Postgres. It's in the contrib functions or the extended modules. It's basically more or less the standard that people use when they're doing sort of relative testing of their Postgres installations to see what their performance is like. It's a simulated TCP/B type of test, if that means anything to you. There's kind of a standard transaction that it runs over and over again, and you can define, you initialize your database with a certain amount of accounts, and then when you're running the benchmark test, you can tell it how many simultaneous connections to use. And it basically, in its default form, it just, if you say use 10 connections, it just runs these queries all out as fast as it can run them. So you can actually, you can swamp your server pretty well with PGBench. In our early testing, that's what we did. We were running, you know, I ran with this dash C is the number of clients that are simultaneous. You know, this testing was all done on a desktop machine, nothing real fancy, nothing real big. So, you know, when you're talking about a four-core machine and you're running with 12 simultaneous clients that are just hammering the database, that's a pretty good load. In the latest set of tests that we did recently, I actually made an adjustment to that, and that is that PGBench comes with the ability to run a custom script. You don't have to run the default script. And if you call PGBench, which is this dash F, and you give it the name of the script, it'll use that script in lieu of its own default. This is the custom script that I used in the latest set of tests. From this point to this end down here is what PGBench does by default. So by default, it sets some variables, it starts a transaction, it does an update on a PGBench accounts, it does a select, it does another update, it does another update, it does an insert. That's the standard set of statements that PGBench does. It has its own kind of pseudo language, and so what I've done down here is I've said, take this variable sleep duration, set a random value between 100,000 and 200,000 and store it in that variable, and then sleep for that duration of microseconds. And so what that allowed me to do is tell, you know, like I said, normally if I ran PGBench with 100 clients on a machine that's got 4 or 6 cores, you know, that machine is brought to its knees. But by adding a slight delay, in this case, somewhere between, it's a random value between 100 and 200 milliseconds, what I can do is I can simulate something more realistic. In that case, I can run PGBench with 100 clients, but now each client basically does this set of work and then it sleeps a little bit. And what that simulates is if you've got a connection pool, if you had a connection pool with 100 connections and you have a web server that's taking requests that are coming in at sort of a constant rate, if you will. As long as that constant rate is something that is less than the amount of time it takes to execute that set of transactions, your active clients never back up. Basically, everything finishes as fast as it's happening, and you don't end up with backed up number of active connections. But if something starts happening on your server that starts slowing things down, now all of a sudden the last one isn't finished before the next one is starting, and so now you've got 2 active connections, and during that period of time you've got even more load, and sort of the whole thing snowballs, and you can quickly go from everything is running quickly and finishing fast, and even though you've got 100 clients that are hammering the server, you never have more than 2 or 3 that are active at any given time, and all of a sudden something sort of loads your server, and next thing you know, you've got 100 active clients all doing work at the same time because the whole thing snowballed. And we did actually see that in some of this testing. Sort of a digression, you know, as an aside, I wrote this little script that lets me look at how many active connections there are at any given time, so that I could watch the behavior and kind of tune my sleep duration, because the sleep duration was dependent on which machine I was running on. On my laptop, I needed a much larger sleep duration for 100 clients than on a machine with 6 cores and 12 gigs of RAM. So now the last little bit is we wanted to simulate kind of this denial of service attack, or something that would just slam the server every so often as we were collecting data. So I'm right on time. So what I did was I created a cron job that would run every 3 hours at 42 minutes after the hour. It would run a select star from, I don't, people ever see this generate series function in Postgres? Generate series just generates a list of rows from 1 to whatever, or from starting point to ending point, and there's even an option for step size. It's kind of a classic iterator. While that's running, though, it's basically building that result set in memory. And then as it's returning it to P PSQL, PSQL's got to hold that whole thing as well. And so I don't know if you can read how many zeros are there, but on this particular machine I was running on, I had enough memory that at 200,000, it wasn't big enough to cause swapping to start happening. So I ended up going to 300 million. So this is doing generate series 1 to 300 million, and that was enough to drive me into swap. 200 million wasn't enough. So when Jeff starts looking at some of the data we collected, you'll see these kind of spikes as we as this thing runs. It would basically drive the server into swap, and as soon as we start swapping, the number of active clients would start to climb, and everything would start taking longer to run. So I think at this point, this is sort of sidebar stuff, so I'm going to let Jeff get started. He's going to talk about some of the analytics that we actually ran on all this data that we collected.
Okay. So this is the part of the presentation with almost no source code, no SQL, and lots of bullet points where the non-sysadmin DBA guy grits his teeth and moves forward. So when Joe and I started talking about this, I was a little dismissive because I am the app builder type guy. I don't want to mess with the back end. As long as the data comes out in some form that I can do my R stuff on, I'm happy. And what was happening is I was getting more and more FaceTime with my PostgreSQL server myself. And so one afternoon, it just happened to be a Friday, which for some bizarre reason, I don't know how you guys, I don't know if this happens to you frequently, but it's always on a Friday afternoon where something bad happens, or just before you're about to go on vacation, or have a child, or something that is totally diverting your attention. And so I got an email saying, Jeff, what's with the server? It doesn't seem to be moving that fast. I don't understand what's going on. And usually it's a problem that you can solve in a few minutes, and this was not one of those times. So what happened was is I decided to bone up on how to do Postgres server admin and basically just camped out in front of my machine for another 72 hours just to make sure I could get moving and not sound like a complete fool when I needed to do sysadmin server stuff. And so essentially what we started to talk about was how can we use the analytics from R with the power of Postgres and combine those two so that we can actually have two great tastes and one candy bar. But we wanted to do it within the context of server analytics and hopefully preemptive analytics so that we could sense when the server's going to choke or when it's going to slow down. So I'm the kind of person who would rather have the option to drink from the fire hose and not, rather than to be restricted up front. So we just started collecting metrics on everything we could get our hands on, realized that that might be a little bit much, so we backed it off a little bit. More importantly, it was critical for us to be able to detect changes quickly, rather than doing post-mortem work, where you come in on a Monday morning and go, wow, nothing's been happening for a day and a half. What's with that? And to be able to use Postgres-friendly tools, we hadn't anticipated using other database backends, and just see what we could do with the basic analytics that are found in R. I don't like to learn new stuff if I don't have to. I don't know if you're the same way, but when emergency strikes, that's usually the last time that you want to learn something new. So we wanted to make sure that we used existing tools, tools that played well with Postgres. We wanted it to be a repeatable process, so zero stochasticity in the outputs and as automated as possible, and that's why we went with cron jobs. So we went with a very roll-your-own attitude to get this moving, and as we developed it, we will fill in the holes as they come up. So anybody intimately familiar with what the entire umbrella of predictive analytics is, or, you know, as far as I'm concerned, anything that includes math, statistics, and black magic falls under predictive analytics. And so for the purposes of what we're talking about, I'm just going to assume that it includes basic statistical modeling, some machine learning, pattern matching, and data mining, which for all intents and purposes are different ways of saying the same thing, which is, can I throw some mathematical horsepower at a messy, censored, chaotic pile of data and glean some useful information out of it? And we're simply just trying to see, one, what happened in the history of the data stream, and two, if we can, predict the future in the near term. So I know people have done work, maybe some of you are here, on when you are going to run out of storage space, or you know, if you're at Google and you're going to try to find out when fail times for hard drives are. That's not the kind of stuff that we're focusing on. We want to use predictive analytics to simply govern and preemptively predict congestion, possibly failure. Predictive analytics is used seemingly everywhere in actuarial science. I'm a forester, so this is something that I back up against repeatedly in either colleagues who are pushing the actuarial tables or actual actuarial science. It's used in insurance. Most of you have probably heard of or have obtained a FICO score. Predictive analytics example, pharmaceuticals, travel healthcare. It's all there. So what we're looking for are causal factors. If we can get away with it, we're looking at correlations of all kinds. Like I mentioned before, we're basically looking for leading indicators of congestion or failures. And we're focusing on Postgres, R, and we're using PLR as the glue that combines those two. And this is a really critical psychological hurdle for a lot of folks that are new to this, because or where I come from, the data, you download the data from some large server somewhere else on the planet, slurp it all down to your desktop, do your analytics on your desktop, print out a report, stick it in the intercompany mail and send it to someone, or put it in email, you know, as a nice one-pager PDF. But the data is actually on the horsepower machine. And so it's really inefficient to slurp all that data off the web, do your analytics, and report back to the mothership. Why can't we just do that on the server using an algorithm that we develop locally, upload that source code to the server, and do it there? And we can control it for automation, accessibility, and all of the good things that come with what goes on the server side. So using PLR is a fantastic tool for merging those two tools. I don't know if we're putting these things up for download, but I've just got a couple of links here to some of the CRAN sites. I don't know if you guys are familiar with CRAN or not. The Comprehensive R Archive Network, like I think CPAN or something like that. And so there are a lot of tools, if you wanted to just look at machine learning. Hopefully this will not gag. And if it does, that's still okay.
You might have to just Alt-Tab to the browser.
Alt-Tab. Whoa. All right. I appear to have gotten dangerous already. All right. So here's an example of one of the links. And these are all of the tools that are available from R for doing machine learning. So I would highly recommend, if you're not familiar with some of these things, go check them out. It's like a freakish amount of stuff that's there. And I cannot make any recommendations on which one is better than the other. Let's see if I can. Oh, got it. Okay. Nope. I'll get there. Document viewer. Ah, okay, cool. Whoa. All right. So, you know, we've been just picking at stuff like some of the multivariate stats. We haven't done time series yet. We've been tossing around thoughts about, well, maybe when we first create the server, we do a little experimental design to exercise. Using PGBench through different sleep times and connectivity so that we can build a response surface and fine-tune the server that way. Well, we may get there. So check them out. Okay, so now I'm just going to go a little bit into some of the predictive analytics work that we've done. It's not incredibly sophisticated, but it's all entry-level stuff that we are looking at developing further. And if you're new to R, this is how you would go and read data. Or if you're reading from a CSV file, it's just read.csv or read table off a disk or something like that. I'm a huge fan of ignoring command or function arguments because I'm assuming that, well, folks just, there's lots of different varieties of how to do this in R, and you've probably got your own favorites. And if you want to load the data and simply generate a scatter plot matrix, that's all you have to do. And if you are I'm an information junkie, I'm okay with that. I hope you are too. But if I wanted to quickly look at a bunch of variables for correlations, this is the first place I go. Quite often in some of the work I do, there are a few hundred of these things, so it won't all fit on one slide. But you can really easily see that, you know, there's some highly correlated data. This whole block down here is highly correlated. There's some stuff that looks like time series. You know, there's some other correlations. So, yeah, you know, we've at least got some place to start if we wanted to build a basic statistical model. Here's a smaller subset of that data. So there's those two in the upper. Can I go back? Nope. Yes, there we go. So there's those two guys right there. Okay, and it still hangs together. We've got some other correlations there. Not too shabby. So two of the first metrics that we were looking at are the swap used, the amount of swap used, and the capture time. So I wanted to model the capture time based on anything I could get my hands on. So I figured swap, which is usually a killer in Postgres, was a good place to start. So Joe mentioned that we take three samples because we originally were thinking about doing statistical process control on this. And interestingly, the little peaks for the swap all correspond, and they're about the same height and the same shape, so yay for that. But the capture times did not have the same pattern in all three of them, which I thought was a little odd, but you know, this was the first time we were looking at this, or first time I was looking at this, so I didn't really know what to expect. So here's another couple of metrics, the number of active and total sessions. And way back when we had a whopping, I think a maximum of 20 sessions, we got blue is the active and red is the total, and it pretty much pegged out near the total all the time. This is from a more recent data set that we've got where the total's in blue here and the active is in red, and it just flip-flops all over the place because we had refined our, I'm guessing you don't want me to update right now.
No,
probably not. Oh, okay. So anyway, so there's that. And, you know, these two anomalies popped up. Interesting. So, okay, being a statistician, the first thing I want to do is see if I can build a model and explain the universe. And so what I do in R here is use the LM, or linear model function. I want to predict the mean capture time. That's the capture time averaged across all three of those observations as a function of the mean swap used. And just print out the summary. And it's that easy. So you get the basic output from the summary function for your model fit, where I have
hold on. A little X to get the...
Yeah, oh, up here.
Should be an X.
No, there is an X. Gotcha. Okay. And so I assign the output of the linear model function to a variable called fit. Hopefully that bar goes away. Or not. Uh-oh. Hold on. This is what happens when I get on a computer. They don't like me. All right. Oh, I'm all over the place. Hold on. Sorry, fellas. Okay. Here we go. So this is the summary output. We got a horrible R squared of 21. I'm not proud of that as a statistician, but that's the breaks. And we've got two. There's our independent variable and an intercept term. And so that's what a model looks like. That's what a basic model of predicting the capture time. So all of that, all of those queries that Joe was running, that's what looks like. So the red is the actual response time, and the black is our predicted response time. So kind of two important things is, yes, it's possible with a minimum set of data, and two, we can actually look at the model itself and see just by plotting the predicted values that, yeah, we can detect spikes. Not very sophisticated, might not be that helpful in a real live environment. So we added a little bit more sophisticated model by adding the memory cached and the amount of swap free, not the amount of swapped used. And this sessions percent variable is a ratio of the number of active to total sessions. There's the parameter estimates with the standard errors and the t-values, and if none of that stuff is interesting to you guys, I'm okay with that. Please ask questions if you wish. I'll never discourage that. And so we've got a little bit better R-squared of 35, 36, meaning we have a little bit better ability to explain the variation in our model. And so this is a little bit more sophisticated model with the predicted response time and the actual response time. So the dark gray here are the actual response times with the updated data, and the red are the predicted response times. And the dashed lines at 10 and 20 seconds are just lines on there for looking at, well, have we bumped over a 20-second response time for more than, you know, the last 5 minutes? If so, maybe we can trigger some kind of signal and reconfigure some variable in the server that doesn't require a restart to throttle connections or something like that, which connections requires a restart, right? Okay. Sorry about that part. Okay. One of the unfortunate things with this model is that we actually predict negative capture times, which means we actually boost performance. No, I'm joking. That's bunk. Okay, so that's the short version for model fitting. Other things that we looked at in our predictive analytics chunk were maybe we want to fit some distributions and do a little bit more sophisticated modeling. So if you haven't done this in R, it's really easy to use the fit distribution function. That is the capture time, and if I wanted to do a Weibull distribution or model it as a gamma, that's all you have to do. So that's, see, I told you, I'm dangerous. Okay, so just close your eyes for a sec. Okay, here we go. So there's a histogram of the capture times from an early data set. Most of the capture times are under 5 seconds, and that's what the distribution fit model looks like, and that is for the gamma. So, excuse me, the blue is the Weibull and the red is the gamma. When we looked at this, almost all of the capture times were under 5 seconds. So this is for the smaller data set that we were using earlier on. And so censoring the data to under 5 seconds yields pretty much the same distribution. And yeah, and there wasn't, I haven't done much work with that part yet. And so, you know, machine learning, if that's something that you think might be interesting or useful for this, I'm just going to give a real quick example for clustering using k-means. So I'm just going to fabricate a data set here and not actually use something that we captured off the server. And so this is creating 100 random normals with a mean of 0 and a standard deviation of 0.3, creating a matrix. So there's that part of the function there. And I'm going to bind the rows of that with another matrix of 100 random normals with a mean of 1 and the same standard deviation, 2 columns. And so assign those X and Y and simply plot those, and that's what that data looks like. So, you know, we've got a cluster around 0 and 0. We've got another cluster around 1 and 1. And in machine learning and One of the things that people want to do is cluster those two into two unique clusters to either reduce the data or something of that nature. And so in R, there's a real simple function called k-means. So we're going to cluster the X data frame, create two clusters, restart it 25 times to make sure that we get consistent results. And then again, just plot the original values with a color from whatever was assigned, whatever cluster was assigned to the output of the k-means function. And I'm going to go ahead and put the k-means points on there. We're at the centers. Just color it black and red. Give it a little star character and make it a little fatter. So there's our original data. Hopefully, we will see a cluster center around here and a cluster center around here, and that's where they are. So we've got two clusters, the red one and the black one, with the center around about one for each one. And if you are going to do clustering kinds of stuff, you want to make sure that you're going to use an appropriate clustering method. So if you need to identify an actual thing, a physical thing, or an observation, or a row, you might want to use something other than k-means, like k-medoids, which will identify, or it'll assign one of the members of that cluster as the center. Right. So here we don't actually have a data point where the center is, but using just means, that's what we get. And how are we doing on time? Okay. And so we gave a presentation similar to this where we were focusing on statistical process control, which when we first started thinking about it sounded really fantastic because it had all of the accoutrements of what would make for a great kind of low cognitive intensity prefab process control environment. Because it's been around for a long time. It's simple, not easy. It's used extensively in manufacturing. You know, originally, I don't know if it was originally developed in Japan, but it's widely used in Japan for manufacturing, and they're kind of known as the instigators of the process. And it's been rebranded for lots of things. So if you're work for Ginormo Corp, they've probably got their own three-letter acronym for it. Maybe patented, maybe not. Part of Six Sigma. It's a pretty powerful tool. And so there, of course, is a package in R for doing that. There are several. And so we were using the QCC package, which works to create short charts for all kinds of data, QSUM, extended weighted moving average charts for continuous data. You can do Pareto charts and the whole works. And we just wanted to do it for very simple, detection. So if we had a data set where we were going to see the first part of it with the swap data for the first 10 observations and we wanted an X-bar chart, and look at the remaining 290 data points to see how they fell in with our first 10 observations. Put that through the QCC function and assign it to the OBJ object. And plot it, and you get something like this. And so if you've seen a normal X-bar chart, it looks nothing like this, right? You have nice, big, wide, or I shouldn't say that you have appropriately wide control limits for the upper and the lower. And so when we put in all of the data, everything kind of collapsed to this because this just looks like a completely out of control process. And so when we plotted the previous set of commands, the control limits snapped in line. However, they're ridiculously small, so we weren't I wasn't appropriately using the QCC infrastructure to use for quality control on the server metrics, and which is kind of why it makes it a work in progress. So some of the criteria that we're using, wanted to make sure that we avoid learning cliffs because the intent was that this was a tool that we were going to work on to provide for people who wanted to be able to plug something in, not spend a week in training, and using the existing tools so far has worked out fantastically. Makes it a repeatable and automated process by simply using cron jobs. And the wizardry of Joe and Postgres development has been fantastic. So some of the stuff that I think we're talking about using or trying to look at next are grabbing more data out of the PG stats statements tables or any of the PG tables. And it seems like every new release, there's a half a dozen more tables that we can access data from. Look at some different data mining techniques, maybe try some pattern recognition, maybe some time series, see if we can apply it up to multiple servers once we perfect it on a single server. And I believe that is it for my portion. Thanks for listening. Thanks for having us. Any questions, comments? If so, feel free to use the microphones. Okay. Thanks for coming.
Just one question.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you looked at any of Baron Schwartz's work from Percona.
Or I have not myself, but I would love to talk about it.
Yeah, he tends to look at the more reactive side of trying to actually distinguish performance failure and then capture the data around that. So he wants to automatically collect the data that surrounds a performance failure event. So it's not so much to predict a failure, but it's kind of two halves of the same coin.
Okay, so like more post-mortem.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Just one note on that. You know, that Postgres does come with an extension. It's called auto-explain. If you're familiar, again, I'm not sure how many people are familiar with explain or explain analyze in Postgres, but that shows you the query plan, basically. Yeah. And if you do explain analyze, it actually shows you the plan along with the actual right next to it.
Oh, very nice.
And auto-explain is an extension where you basically say for any query that takes more than a certain amount of time to run, I want the explain analyze of that query dumped into the log. So you can basically say anything that takes more than 5 seconds to run, it dumps the entire query plus the explain analyze at that point in time into the log so you could do post-mortem on it.
Yeah, obviously that's useful, but of course there could be extraneous factors that might be causing performance issues as well.
Sure, and there are other, you know, other tools that people use like SAR and things of that nature that collect data that you can go back to and
another problem with that type of approach is just that how do you know how long to set that threshold to? It depends on the query.
Yeah, the threshold depends
on the distribution of queries you happen to be running.
Yeah, or it might be a metric that applies to your environment. In some environments, 200 milliseconds is too long for a query to take, and in other environments,
bingo.
You know, 10 seconds is fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, it's really very dependent on your requirements.
Yeah. So he was looking for some sort of statistical approach that would take, you know, baseline data and then compare that to individual events. And the key was not having to tweak dials or anything, just have the computer figure out what the appropriate thresholds are.
Okay.
Baron Schwartz, he works for Percona, which is a MySQL, you know, other,
I'm,
you know, the competitors.
But, I'm familiar with
but
Baron
he's a good guy.
And with Percona. Yeah. Any other questions?
Source available?
Source?
Yeah.
For PLR or for
the
work that we did?
Well, set of tools that you've written so far.
The script
collection.
It's not on my website yet, but it certainly can be any time now.
Be.
So, I mean, basically, yeah. Next time I think about it, I'll post the presentation PDF as well as a SQL script with all of the functions and stuff that we showed.
Yeah, that'd be really handy. Thanks.
Yeah. So it'll be on. I don't have my URL up there. It's joeconway.com is where PLR can be found. If you Google PLR, you'll find it.
Is anyone using PLR in a production environment?
Any other questions? Thank you.